From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I thought I was going to sing a cappella this hour, but we're not. It's our monthly science roundtable, and our connection this hour is made in the myriad electrical signals and connections in our own brains. The understanding of the human brain has evolved, of course, and now, at least according to a local PhD candidate, we can see the brain and its connections in breathtaking detail. But so what? How can we use this new knowledge of the brain? Can we use it to zero in on parts of the brain that impact behavior? And what does the history of research on the brain tell us? That's just one question that we will start to sort through in our monthly science roundtable. We're heading out to the Rochester Museum and Science Center this hour, which is hosting a pair of lectures this month as part of their Science on the Edge speaker series, one on the brain, another on photovoltaics. And we're also going to learn about a big exhibit on the mysterious adaptabilities of frogs. So you cannot have a more wide-ranging science roundtable than this hour. And with that, let me welcome my guests. Dan Manili is here, and Dan is the Chief Science Officer for the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It's nice to have you here, Dan.
Thank you.
Also here is John O'Donnell, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Rochester Medical Center. John, welcome. And Stephen Polly's here. He's a RIT graduate. He's got a PhD in microsystems engineering. Dr. Polly, nice to have you here.
Thanks, Evan.
We've got a lot to talk about this hour. I'm going to start with John because John is giving a presentation on Thursday night at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Dan, what do people need to know about Thursday night's presentation as part of this speaker series? Free, I think.
Free to this audience, yeah, and to come a little early so you have some chance to wander through the 200 exhibits that we have, including the frogs exhibition.
All right, so we're going to be getting to frogs coming up here. Thursday night, John, you're talking about the brain and the way our brains are wired, but specifically, what kind of research have you been doing on this, and what are you going to kind of give us a sense about on Thursday night?
So for the talk Thursday night, when we were first sitting down and trying to come up with what we were going to talk about, we looked at it and we saw that there are a lot of great techniques and a lot of great ways that we have come to have now to understand the brain. So Thursday night is mostly going to focus on a historical perspective of how we've come to know what we do about the brain, as well as the sorts of techniques and the ways that we can now look at the neurons or the different parts of the brain in order to understand how it works.
Okay. Now, for your research in particular, are you aiming to resolve for us whether this understanding of the brain can help us change behaviors and activity? Is it for other functions? What's the sort of practicality of it?
For my research in particular is on sleep,
okay.
Actually.
On sleep.
Yeah.
but the presentation on Thursday, what should we know about just understanding this sort of history and the way our brains are wired?
We should understand that for a long time, we sort of broke the brain down into these different chunks, and we figured out that different parts of the brain are necessary for how we think or how we feel or how we recognize faces. But in recent decades, and actually really within the last decade, we found different ways to take the neurons in the brain, the fundamental components carrying the information, and to excite them or to figure out what they're doing to actually produce the way that we perceive the world.
Okay. What do you think we'll be able to do with this in the future?
That's a broad question. in the near future, we should be able to begin to understand like how we encode memories, like how you have your fear memories, the memories that give you nightmares. And we should be able to understand how we might be able to start to change those and how we can continue to build our understanding of how the brain works in order to change.
I see. This is what's fascinating to me. Is this what dovetails with sleep for you, for your own research?
Yeah, it does, loosely, but it
okay.
does.
All right. Well, tell me a little about the sleep research, and then I want to just ask a follow-up on what you just told us. But tell me first about your sleep research.
So my research for my PhD is focused on the role of or how we clean the brain during sleep, mm-hmm. or how you have fluid in the brain that just flushes through to take away the toxins and the metabolites that you have from the entire day of being awake.
I've spent the last few years thinking a lot more about sleep because of some of my own sleep disorders, which I'm not going to bore the audience with. But you know, very honestly, you think about the term sort of flushing or cleaning and the way that process is happening or what the function of sleep is. John, do we know what the actual function, the purpose of sleep is?
I think there are a lot of purposes of sleep. from my research, one of the reasons that we sleep is so that we can actually just clean out the brain.
But what does that mean? Is that a physical process, or is that sort of like a rest theoretical process? It's
an actual physical process. Yeah, of actually flowing, of actually having fluid flow through the brain to carry out these toxins or to carry out like excess amyloid beta, which is related to Alzheimer's.
Okay. And that happens, and we need, you know, this is where a lot of people start wondering, do we need the 8 hours? I hear a lot of people say, well, I've learned to function on 5. You know, I've adapted to it. I can do it. I can handle it. Can the brain do that? Do we have evidence about that?
I think there are some lucky people who have who actually can get away with that. Otherwise, for most people, you probably do need at least 6 in order to get like this full clearance, in order to give all the restorative properties that we get from sleep.
Okay, and because I think what I recall in recent years, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm erring here, but I think if I recall correctly, the flushing process that you're talking about doesn't happen the moment we fall asleep. It takes some time to get into. Is that right?
Yeah, it does take a little bit of time to get into. It's in those deepest parts of sleep or where we think that these flushing processes are working.
Okay, and then back to sort of the question on dreams and nightmares and the way our memories are stored and what this kind of work is telling us. Do we want to manipulate that in any way? Is there, in your mind, is there a risk to manipulating the way our brain is processing that?
I think that there is a risk in how far you take it. There's certainly a lot of benefit that you could get with, say, people who have PTSD, so that we can understand like what has changed in their brains and is there a way to mitigate that. But yeah, naturally there's a risk once you start toying with your own memories.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, so many of us were exposed to this concept through fiction with The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which, have you seen, John?
I have seen it.
Is that the kind of film that you think, great, now the lay public thinks they understand what we're aiming to do here and we've got a terrible understanding of this, or do you think, well, it was fun?
I mostly just thought it was fun. but it does bring up, like, it makes people think about any ethical questions that you could have the more that we come to understand the brain, so...
Yeah, and so for someone with PTSD, I don't have it, so I certainly understand the desire of using this understanding of science and applying it in this way. But on a night-to-night basis, I don't know if there's a purpose for nightmares outside of PTSD. I have no idea, to be honest with you, and where they come from. And, you know, so is that part of what, you know, you're curious about? Is that part of what this kind of work can tell us?
Yeah, I think that it's very related. Like, I don't know if there's necessarily a purpose for nightmares, but definitely sleep is important for actually forming the memories and solidifying them from all of your day's experiences. And nightmares may be an effect of that, but it's absolutely necessary for memory.
And here's a question that could probably take us down a rabbit hole, but I'll just ask you. Do you think there's such a thing as free will?
That is a tough question. I'd like to hope there is, but...
Isn't there some thought that the way our brains are wired and the experiences we have the illusion of free will?
That there's an overlay from the brain that just gives a perception that you've decided.
You're right.
But even if some of what we do is just subconscious, maybe that's still... free will, but that's still part of your brain.
See, I agree with you, John. I like to think that we do anyway, and I'm just going to bank on the fact that we do in some way. So, John, you can see him and hear more about his presentation on Thursday night at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. The name of the presentation, Are We Wired to Think or Just Thinking of Wires? And John will be out there. That's 6:30 on Thursday night, and it's free. Then the following Thursday, the 17th, is Dr. Stephen Pauly. It's The Physics of Photovoltaics from the Beginning to Next Generation Nanotechnologies. You're going to do all of that in like an hour, 90 minutes or so?
Yeah, it's going to have to be quick.
Yes, it's a lot to cover. But your PhD, again, is in
Microsystems engineering.
Microsystems engineering, which means what for those of us who are not microsystems engineers?
Well, it's kind of a catch-all. It's a broad term. RIT likes to have sort of niche majors that encapsulate a number of different things. But it's basically everything from solid-state electronics to microfluidics, MEMS, basically anything very small that you can do engineering on and have some sort of effect in society. So.
Okay. And what brought you into photovoltaics then? And actually, let me back up and ask you to define the term photovoltaics. I don't want to make it.
Sure. So photovoltaics, solar cells, they're the same thing. It's taking light from the sun and converting it into electrical energy that we can use to power, you know, a radio station, for example.
Okay. and maybe someday will?
Yeah, absolutely. Probably sooner rather than later, based on the way things are going.
Okay. So what brought you into photovoltaics specifically?
Interestingly, originally, a neighbor up the street from me growing up was a systems ecologist at SUNY ESF. And he was always complaining about or telling me about how the world was running out of oil when I was growing up and helping him in his garden. And that led me to RIT ultimately and looking at learning about how computer chips were built and worked. And that was always really interesting to me. It combined physics and chemistry. And then ultimately I met my advisor at RIT, and he was doing solar cell research. And I just sort of glommed onto him and stuck with him throughout undergraduate and graduate education. So.
And so you had a neighbor up the street who told you the world's running out of oil, and that stuck with you.
Dr. Charlie Hall, yep.
Wow. Does he know? Do you give him credit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah? Yeah. And Stephen was working in school with someone he works with now, with Rockspot, and it's one of our guests who's going to be on tomorrow's program. That's Dr. Susan Spencer. And Susan, the founder of Rockspot, is someone who I think has the exact same degree as you. Is that right?
Yes, we got the same degree from the same program.
Okay, who's first?
She was first.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's going to be on tomorrow talking about sort of the future of energy and the interaction of leaders in new forms of energy with utilities, with the RG&Es of the world, as we figure out this relationship, this bridge into the future. And so on tomorrow's first hour, we are going to be talking about that. Adam Chodak from WROC-TV did a series of reports last month about that. He went out to Vermont, where there is, I would say, a pretty well-embraced set of new energies from the utility there. But then, you know, you look at Arizona, some other places where utilities are not necessarily embracing it, assessing fees, those kind of things. That's the first hour tomorrow. Susan Spencer will be here. And Dr. Polly works with Susan at Rockspot, yes?
Absolutely.
You work with Rockspot. So remind our audience what Rockspot is.
Rockspot is a number of different things, but primarily what I work on is trying to get education out there into the community to explain to people how solar energy can work in Rochester, and also work on the consulting side and talk to some of the larger players in Rochester community to try to teach them about how it can be financially viable for them and sort of what the process is for getting that and helping them get solar installed on their properties.
Okay, so much has changed in the history of photovoltaics, for example, that you can graduate from RIT with a PhD in microsystems engineering, and this can be a viable economic future for you. One of the conversations that they've been having in Paris, for example, over the last week, is not just on what kind of forms the world of energy that the world can use, but also what's an economically viable set of energy alternatives. And we hear a lot about solar. We hear a lot about solar getting bigger than coal, for example. But that probably wasn't true a number of years ago. I mean, maybe 5 years ago, maybe 10, certainly 25 and 50. So what is the history that you're going to work through on the 17th at the Rochester Museum and Science Center?
Right. So the history of solar cells really dates back to the late 1800s. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time there because there's not really a whole lot to talk about that's relevant today. But moving forward into the 1954 sort of discovery of a PN diode, which is the type of solar cells that we typically use today, starting off around 6% efficiency, moving forward through different kinds of technologies, different elemental properties. So the original solar cells are made of silicon. More advanced, more highly efficient solar cells are made of things like gallium arsenide, copper, indium, gallium diselenide, other sort of interesting combinations of different parts of the periodic table. Ultimately moving towards these very, very advanced solar cells that are meant for space applications or very high concentration, which is where you take a lot of light from a large area and concentrate that light into a very small area. So you have a lot of inexpensive glass or plastic or mirrors focusing light into a very small area of very expensive solar cells. But those have reached 46% efficiency. So I'll be talking about sort of the history of where things have been, where they're going, and specifically my research and my PhD work working on quantum dot solar cells with sort of nanotechnology approaches of manipulating the way that natural elements and natural materials work in order to get the most effect out of the solar spectrum that we have.
6% efficiency back when for
1954.
Solar cells? 1954. But what exactly, I mean, in my mind, I think I know what 6% efficiency means, but what exactly does that mean?
It means that from the available light from the sun, so the solar spectrum, it's everything that we can see. It's all the visible light, but there's also a lot of ultraviolet and a lot of infrared that we can't see. All of that light combined is your input energy. And if you can convert 6% of that out, then you're converting 6% of typically the amount of light that falls on the Earth is considered to be about 1,000 milliwatts per square centimeter. Or sorry, 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. And so 6% of that would mean that out of a one square centimeter cell of solar cell, you can get about 6 milliwatts for 6%.
What's the efficiency today?
It depends on what type of material you're using. For the kind of solar cells that you put up on a roof, it's anywhere from sort of 12 to 18%, depending on the type of technology. For the solar cells we put into space, for example, the highest efficiency solar cells, I believe, on a mission right now is the Juno mission to Jupiter. Those are using very, very advanced triple junction solar cells, which have three different types of materials altogether. Those are probably around 38% efficiency here at Earth. At Jupiter, they're much lower because there's a lot less light available. But the very highest efficiency ever recorded to date is 46%. And that was under, I believe, 200 or 300 suns concentration. So 200 or 300 times the area concentrated down to a smaller area.
Okay. So, and this is where I need your expertise in context to tell me if my reaction to what you're telling me is fair or not. So first of all, when I hear 6% efficiency in 1954 with some of the early solar cells, does that mean 94% is wasted of that light?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes?
So 94% is either it goes right through it in the same way that light goes through a window. Some of that's just lost right to transmission. Some of it is lost because the solar cell is not able to efficiently convert photons of specific energies to electrons as efficiently as other energies. And some of it is reflected. So some of it just bounces off and goes back up into space.
It's a lot wasted.
Absolutely.
All right. And today, 12 to 18%. And I think some of our listeners would have guessed the number would be higher. Where do you think we're going? How efficient can we expect to get with solar cells in the future?
So there's a lot of sort of thermodynamic arguments that govern exactly how efficient you can get. For a single material, so a single material like silicon, though silicon is not exactly optimized for our solar spectrum, you can get about 31% efficiency out of a single material. By putting multiple materials together, you can increase that efficiency up towards, if you have an infinite number of materials, it's around, I think, 76% efficient. So, you know, in that range is sort of where we're looking to go towards in the future. Silicon, I believe the best efficiency silicon cells that have been produced by University of New South Wales in Australia are around 25%. So if you want to spend a little bit more, you can get very, very high efficiency devices, but the cost per watt is considerably high. And if you're trying to make something that's that efficient anyway, you might want to go to these more advanced materials like what I was working on for my PhD, which you would end up putting into space where the cost per watt does not matter quite as much as the watts per kilogram because it's so expensive to send weight up into space.
But this is like any other technology. The goal over time is for the cost to come down mm-hmm. and efficiency to go up, right?
Absolutely. So for sort of commercial and residential people, putting solar up on your roof, putting solar up on a business, the main metric that you want to worry about is cost per watt. So this is where economies of scale and sort of production of silicon solar cells, even though they're not the most efficient available, silicon is an incredibly abundant material. So, and we also have a long history of using silicon for making devices like computer chips, computer memory. Basically, the whole integrated circuit revolution is all born on silicon. So we have a lot of experience working with silicon. And silicon is really a quite mature technology as far as the efficiencies of it go. But the cost per watt is driving down as more and more solar foundries are produced and more material is made.
Okay. In 1954, was it silicon? What were they using then?
It was silicon. The first devices were actually selenium, I believe. But silicon was the first sort of announced or journal articled paper. And silicon then, it was in the very early stages. We were just discovering integrated circuits and just, you know, sort of seeing what these types of devices could do. So silicon has sort of been around the whole way, and we've gotten a lot out of it.
You could say that since 1954, we have doubled or tripled the efficiency of the solar cells that we're using, if we're talking about, for example, the panels we might put on a house or a business. But some might say, well, we're still only at 12 or 18%. Is it unrealistic? I mean, would you tamp down anyone's expectations that we should be at 90%? I mean, look, we have no idea what
the technology
absolutely.
So is, right? It's like I said, the figure of merit that you really want to worry about is the cost per watt. So back in 1954, the amount of money that you would spend to produce a watt of electricity was thousands and thousands of dollars. Today, in 2015, it's about $2 per watt. or it can be even less depending on exactly what type of system you put in, and exactly where it's going and how big of a system you're able to put in. And that cost per watt has been driving down significantly over the past several years.
Okay. So that's where we're going. Why didn't you want to talk about the 1800s? I'm curious to know what was happening in the 1800s.
Well, it's just we had such a limited understanding of how the world worked back then. This was before Einstein, before sort of the idea of quantization of light. And back then it was, you know, if we shine light on this material and put wires coming off of it and measure the current, it produces something, but we don't really know why. So I'm going to touch on that in the presentation on next Thursday, but it's sort of just the very early baby steps in understanding how these materials can work and how they can provide electricity to the world.
Were there people, were there scientists in the 19th century who suspected that this was a part of the future, that there was a lot more that could happen?
Yes. The people that were doing the work initially definitely felt that this was, you know, the next age. This was going to replace coal. And it didn't really catch on right away because it wasn't really well understood, and the efficiencies and the ability for it to transform photons into electricity was very, very low. So it wasn't really ever picked up until people started working with it again in the 50s. And it was really the space race and getting, you know, powering satellites, which is where solar cells really came into their own, that it started picking up again. And again, the oil embargo in the 1970s also helped that to some degree.
So, Dr. Pauly, you've given us a good picture of how solar cells are made, some of the materials used, the efficiencies. And if this is going to be a big part of the energy future and economic development going into the future, I think what we're seeing now is going to continue to play out. Probably some good competition, healthy free market competition among companies. What are they racing to do? Are they trying to essentially continue to create more efficient cells with lower cost? You know, what are the actual scientific achievements they are trying to come up
with? It's all cost. So there's lots of ways of addressing cost. In the world of silicon, it's all about just having as much production as you possibly can. There are other materials and other routes, though, that people may want. So there are thin film solar cells. There are solar cells that are flexible. There are solar cells that are partially transparent, like some of what Dr. Spencer worked on. There are a number of different avenues that people might want to have sort of niche applications of solar cells. I was at a conference this summer that was talking about solar cells for architectural purposes, where they actually put a coating on the solar cell to make it reflect white light. So it looked like a white sort of wall that you might see on just, you know, a normal building, but it was still able to capture some amount of the infrared light that was able to pass through that white coating, so you wouldn't even know a solar cell was there necessarily. Now, that's not very good as far as a energy conversion mechanism, but it might be something that you want for an architectural project. So really there's a lot of different ways of driving down the cost, whether that's low efficient solar cells that are very flexible and can be produced roll to roll, like some of these 2-6 they're called compounds they're able to do. There's a new class of materials called perovskites that have just completely exploded in their sort of learning curve. They've gone from I think like 6-7% efficiency to over 20 in the past few years. And it's this sort of new class of materials that people are very heavily working on.
How have they done that? I mean, how has that happened?
It's just people have discovered that this particular type of sort of mixture of organic and inorganic materials has a lot of properties that are very effective for solar energy conversion. And actually, I was at a conference in Boston this past week, where almost all of the solar cell talks were on these perovskite materials, because it's very exciting to see a material that's increasing its efficiency so quickly. And based on sort of the properties of it, it may be able to reach that 31% efficiency. But again, that's something that only time will tell as far as the research goes.
Andy on Twitter says, getting blown away by the brain power we've got here in Rochester right now. Hashtag smart cookies, hashtag science roundtable. Thank you, Andy. I agree about Don and John and Dr. Pauly, who've been telling us about their presentations that are coming up at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. You can see John O'Donnell on this coming Thursday, two nights from now, 6:30 p.m. He is talking about the wiring of the human brain. Are we wired to think? We're just thinking of wires. That is Thursday night, and it's free. And then Stephen Pauly is presenting on photovoltaics, which we've been talking about here. And he is doing that two Thursdays from now, Thursday night, December 17th. And you can attend at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. I've got a number of your questions coming in, and let me just kind of work through a couple of them here. Alan sends kind of a long email and just wanted to know, he said, forgive his ignorance, but throughout time, we've occasionally discovered new materials and then found that there were unintended consequences. the asbestoses of the world. Are there any concerns with some of the materials that solar is using?
People certainly have concerns, yeah. I mean, so silicon, the ingredients to a silicon solar cell are typically silicon, which is sort of comes from sand, phosphorus, boron, aluminum, sort of things that, you know, aren't particularly known for being very hazardous. Some of the materials that I worked on included arsenic, so gallium arsenide. The perovskites I was just talking about use lead. So there are a lot of different types of concerns for these materials, and some of them have not been well studied. In the case of gallium arsenide, the arsenic is bound into the crystal, and it's not really going anywhere. And some of them you would encapsulate in other materials when you actually make a module out of them. So, but concerns about sort of how to recycle these things end of life are certainly part of what other groups are studying as part of sort of a sustainability and a holistic application of this type of technology. But it's certainly a concern and worth bearing in mind as you're doing some of the research on these materials.
Okay, you're at least thinking about those questions going forward. Yeah, that's a good question, Alan. Jake's got questions for both of our presenting guests who are speaking as part of the series. So first, for the photovoltaics guy, Jake says, I've heard of dozens of major breakthroughs in both solar and battery technologies in the last 2 years, but it takes 5 to 10 years to get from the lab to consumer products. Any hint at what's coming out next as far as large-scale consumer technologies?
That's an interesting question. I think that probably more flexible technologies are going to become more common and more cost viable as far as being able to put solar cells in sort of more interestingly shaped structures. But as far as sort of the typical panel that you'd put on your roof, that's probably going to still be primarily silicon as for the foreseeable future, just based on the cost of the material. But as these other things start to build up in their production, it's really hard to tell. There's a lot of different technologies that are all in the same sort of category as far as their cost per watt, that are all sort of vying for a seat in what's going to become the next dominant thing. So it's really hard to tell exactly right now what's might become popular on a commercial scale.
Silicon 10 years from now we'll still see on roofs, 20 years from now?
I'm sure, yeah.
50?
Possibly. Some of the very high efficiency materials include some rare elements, so there probably will never be a case where, you know, the rooftops of all of America are covered with the kind of things that I was working on for my PhD. But some of these other materials, as the ability to, for example, for perovskites or for organic solar cells, keeping them stable over a long period of time, once that sort of gets figured out and we're able to have very long-term applications of them, those could very well take over and become a cheaper alternative to silicon.
Okay. And John O'Donnell, Jake writes that says, I'm familiar with basic EKG charts and fMRI imaging to study the brain. Could your guest briefly cover if there are other imaging techniques that are in use today?
EKG and fMRI are definitely two of the major ones. There are a number of other techniques like PET imaging where you can look at different isotopes. But in terms of looking at the brain, particularly in animals, we have a lot of other techniques where we can use like two-photon microscopy, which is basically exciting fluorescent molecules that we've put into those brains in order to see whether or not their calcium increases or whether or not there are changes in pH. Beyond that, there are some other techniques, but not much.
And what is fMRI? That's MRIs that we're used to, the term. Magnetic resonance?
Yeah. fMRI uses it's similar to MRI technique, only it uses the oxygenation level of the blood in order to figure out which parts of the brain have been activated during various tasks or when you're just at rest.
Got it. Very good. Jake, hope that answered that question. A couple of our guests have wanted to know if the more efficient solar panels will last longer, Dr. Polly. And Joel writes to us, solar panels on the White House in the 1970s still in use today. I don't know if that's true. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
Yep. And there's been just new ones put up in 2013, I believe.
I was going to say, if you put them up in the 70s, 40 years ago, not as nearly as efficient, I wouldn't think, right?
Probably similar efficiencies, probably a little bit lower, but certainly a lot more expensive back then.
Okay.
The thing with silicon and solar cells, and sort of the silicon solar cells specifically, and some of the more solid state, or rather crystalline solar cells, they're kind of like light emitting diodes, and sort of the light bulbs that we're able to get for your house now, and that they sort of last forever. There's not really any moving parts. There's nothing to burn out. So once you have the solar cell, it doesn't really degrade that much. The cover glass that protects them, and some of the adhesives that are in there can degrade and can cause problems and can sort of darken over time. But apart from that, the actual solar cell itself, as long as it's not destroyed by, you know, like a hammer or something, or it's not heated to temperatures well beyond what Earth normally experiences, like in a fire or something like that, it might degrade. But apart from that, they don't really do anything.
Now, you're with Rockspot, so I got to be careful not to give you too many softballs on this, but I'm going to ask you two questions that come up all the time with this subject, which is, how durable are cells today? Are they more durable now than they would have been 20, 30, 40 years ago? As in, especially in this kind of a climate, can we trust putting them up that they will be there for a while? So let's start there. Durable?
Yeah, absolutely. The solar cells that we put up, or not, we don't put up any solar cells, but that one would put up, are rated against, I believe, like golf ball sized hail. I don't know exactly what the rating is, but they're rated to well within any kind of weather condition that we would typically experience. And really, they're it's like a glass window or something like that. Like if you you know, throw a rock really hard at it, you'll break it. But apart from that, they're incredibly durable and last an incredibly long time.
Another question that comes up often is, you know, we hear people who say, well, I don't want to buy the next iPhone because there's another iPhone coming out 6 months from now. I don't want to buy the next computer because there's another one coming out 6 months after that. And there's a concern that there's always this this race to become obsolete.
Right.
And what do you say to customers who say, is now a good time? Should I wait a year? Do I wait 2 years for cost and efficiency?
Yeah, so now is actually a really good time for solar.
I knew you were going to say
New York State.
But go ahead.
Well, so the reason, and you probably well know, is that if you were to put up solar cells in your house right now, you get a 30% tax credit from the federal. You get a 25% federal or state tax credit, and you also get incentives from NYSERDA, which go right to your installers, and that's based on how many watts you're putting in. And that incentive actually is decreasing over time. So as more and more solar cells are put in, the amount of money that you're able to get from New York State to help subsidize that decreases.
Okay.
So right particularly now is a really, really good time. But either way, I mean, the solar cell efficiencies themselves are not really going to increase that much over time, likely. The cost will come down, but if those incentives go away, the cost will go back up for a little while until economies and scale will help to bring it back down again.
So I'm not sitting here buying an Advantix camera when digital's coming out, in other words. That's not what's happening with anybody buying solar today,
right,
compared to 2 years, 5 years from now.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hope that answers that question. And I'm way late, but I got to grab one more phone call. Dan in Brighton wants to weigh in as well. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I don't want to be nitpicky. I think the guest accidentally said EKG when he meant EEG, yeah, referring to recording brainwaves. I think the question was about fMRI on brainwaves. And another resource is quantitative electroencephalography, which can be give people a reasonable cost to view their EEG against normative database, and then you can build biofeedback and neurofeedback protocols to address a number of psychiatric problems that come from that, and I know that because I do that.
Thank you, Dan. Fair enough, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. And I'm going to go ahead and blame Jake. Jake is a regular writer to the program, and he loves the Science Hours, and he's one of the smartest listeners we have, and he set me up with that. He did write EKG, and I always trust that Jake is infallible in science matters. So, Jake, you owe me a coffee. A short break. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about what else is going on at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It is our monthly science roundtable. You've been hearing from a couple of the presenters who are coming up this month as part of their Science on the Edge lecture series. John O'Donnell presenting this Thursday night at 6:30 p.m. about the brain. It's free. And then Dr. Stephen Pauly on photovoltaics and the next generation of nanotechnology as well and the way it impacts photovoltaics. That's coming up next Thursday night, nine nights from now, also at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Short break and more Science Roundtable next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, are utilities going to get on board with a multi-energy future? By that we mean, what do utilities think about solar? Are they going to assess fees to customers who get panels on their roofs? Or are they going to get on board? We'll find out. And then, in our second hour, talking about race, often we hear from experts, we're going to talk to some average Joes who want to be more self-aware. That's Wednesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Rohrbach Brewing Company, a craft brewery and tasting room located on Railroad Street near the Rochester Public Market, offering tours, beer tastings, and a space for private events. More information available online at rohrbachs.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This is our monthly science roundtable. It's always the first Monday, second hour of every month, but yesterday we had our Hanukkah Lights special programming, and hope you enjoyed that. So we've moved the Science Roundtable to the first Tuesday of this month, and the Rochester Museum and Science Center has a lot going on, and I want to bring in their chief program officer, their chief science officer. Oh my gosh, Dan, every time I've got you here, I've got you the wrong title, but it's the best of intentions. Nice to have you back here, Dan, and you have a lot going on. You were smiling listening to so much of what you've been hearing from these two presenters. I know you've gotten to know them, and it's probably fun for you to hear them describe their passions, their subjects that they're presenting on here.
We're really excited. We're proud of the Science on the Edge lecture series because it's a special audience for us. It's a really deep dive into exciting topics. Life science and energy literacy are two nodes that we're looking at across the institution, so these are important conversations.
They're great for our audience, too. When I started this program, I had listeners very specifically say, please don't just water down the science. Now, there are times where I think we've got to be careful not to get too far down in the weeds. And you played a little bit of alphabet soup with the elements with us, Dr. Polly, but that's okay. I think in many ways, I can see just in 20 minutes talking to him, Dan, how good of a communicator he is, how good of a communicator John is, that they can help us understand these concepts in ways that do not sort of put any training wheels on the science, but at the same time aren't going to go past us. And that is a special skill to have, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's a mission critical priority for the museum to open up these communications, to make them meaningful to all audiences. We actually have a program at the museum called Portal to the Public where we train scientists on how to communicate in an informal learning context. So we're really proud of this type of work.
All right, well, you've got other things going on as well at the Rochester Museum and Science Center, frogs in particular. Now, what's going on with frogs there?
Well, you know, this exhibit is an exciting one. We presented it through a new model of science exhibitions. We call it our new hybrid model, our signature model. We've taken treasures from our collections, including poison dart guns and objects and animal mounts from our zoological collection, and we've really integrated three different types of experiences in addition to the 92 rare frogs, so 16 species from all over the world. It's a beautiful exhibit. The audience is so enthusiastic, and we're really, really proud of it.
How many? We don't have that many types of frogs around here, I think, but there's frogs around the world. And so I'm kind of going through the list here. Sure-footed tree frogs. Are those the kinds we have around here? What do we have here? I have no idea.
White's tree frogs, I believe. Okay. Gray's tree frogs.
Okay. And then you've got the Argentinian horned frog, the jewel-toned poison dart frog.
Yeah, those are fed each morning at Monday mornings at 9:30, I believe. We have a husbandry specialist who travels with the exhibition. And if you look on our newly engineered web spaces, you'll see that they have public feedings of the poison dart frogs. They look jewel tone. They look like lapis in the tank, and they're fascinating.
Do you simply, you know, whatever employee has given you the most trouble, do you send them in there to feed the poison frogs?
No, actually, we have that's done by the husbandry specialist, but I admire your thinking.
So jewel-toned poison dart frog. And again, what we're learning here is just how adaptable this kind of is species the wrong word? Are they families of species? I guess I always get this wrong here, but the frogs are so adaptable around the world to their environment, I guess.
Yeah, they also contain important ecological messages about the overall health of an ecosystem, and we can study and learn from them. And we can also study the way viruses travel through them and bodies of water. I mean, it's a huge topic. This exhibition is about so much more than frogs themselves. They tell an important story about our environment and the way organisms have adapted to survive. And, you know, there are some just striking organisms. The African bullfrog alone is fabulous. It's about 8 pounds. It's a huge. This is something you're never going to see. He's huge. Absolutely.
That's
huge.
That's the size of like a normal house cat.
It looks like a dinner plate.
It's a frog.
Size of a dinner plate. Yep.
What color is it?
He's a gray green, sort of a sage gray green. He's countershaded so that he fits into his environment.
Wow.
In the wild, eats mice, birds. Huge.
It's a frog.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that the largest frog that you have?
It's the largest in the exhibition, yeah. There is one larger species, but it would be too stressed out to be on public exhibit, but we have a skeleton of it, and it's pretty amazing. We actually have a human skeleton, too, in the exhibition that was loaned to us by Wards because we wanted visitors to look at the comparative structure of humans and frogs, to look at the bone structures and how they're engineered for different environments.
So there's one species that is larger.
Yes.
But you said something interesting there. This wouldn't be an appropriate environment. It wouldn't be right to it.
No, it would be too stressful, and they would jump against the size of the tank and be injured. I really admire the way this exhibition is curated because these frogs are handled in a very humane way. They're not stressed out. They even carefully control the light and temperature conditions of the exhibition gallery. It's done well, and these organisms, you know, they're on display. You can get right up close to them, but they're also handled and they're secure and safe, and that was very important to us.
Yeah, I always am curious when it comes to bringing animals out of a natural habitat to be observed or studied, because I wonder, do they behave as they would in a natural habitat? And if they don't, do we lose a learning opportunity? What do you think?
Well, animal behavior is one of those, it's a difficult subject to approach because we simply don't know how to interpret it accurately. We can study their behavior in terms of the statistics of what types of things they do in certain settings, but it's hard to understand what their experiences are. These organisms, though, are very carefully handled, and they're living treasures, and we're proud to display them.
Okay. So how many frogs total do you have?
About 92.
92.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And sometimes at the Science Center, you really aim an exhibit at kids or families, et cetera. Who's the target audience here?
There really wasn't one for this. We use a vertically integrated model, and when we designed the exhibition, we really wanted to create spaces in the exhibit for every guest. So there are story spaces for the youngest learners with beautiful puppets and books and manipulatives, and then there's new media and video installations that go really deep into the science stories behind the species and the studying of them. It's a beautiful exhibit, and it's fun to watch families come together and the conversations. That's what we specialize in, are opening these transgenerational conversations between grandparents and their grandchildren about what excited them.
And Dan, since you became chief science officer here at the Rochester Museum and Science Center, have you had a goal to, I mean, everybody wants more attendance. Everybody wants more in general. Are you reaching out to kids more? You know, what are some of your focuses?
Well, right now we're working across the divisions to look at different audiences. I'm excited about the enrichment audience, the people, because people are living longer into their 90s. I'm very fascinated by people in their 60s or 70s that come, and not just as guests, but also are active and working as docents and volunteering. The school audience is one of the reasons we chose the frogs exhibition, as it's such a tight linkage to the third grade curricula in our region. There's a book on frogginess. Today we were packed with schools and school audience and programs, and including our own, where the kids were doing field research in the exhibition with journaling activities developed by Cara Verna, who works on our team. It's a vertically integrated model, meaning we really did think carefully about each age group that could come, and we're proud that, you know, the feedback we're getting is that it's really interesting and meaningful to all learners.
Now, when it comes to the frogs, did they make a... It's got to be an interesting set of sounds that you probably
hear. It is. I would love to have a sleepover in there for school. We have sleepovers at the museum. I'd love scout troops to come and sleep there and hear them call, the calling of the frogs. But there's also a video installation and new media that it shows all different types of calling. And also at our Coming Nature Center in the spring, we actually have content where the groups that have come and teachers that have trained for professional development in the frogs exhibition and brought their classes to the exhibit will also go to our Coming Nature Center and do field research in April when the frogs call. And this time they're calling the kids from 40 schools that will be presented there.
See, producer Megan Mack and I, we missed a chance there, Meg. We should have gone out there with a Marantz and recorded some of the sounds of these frogs, but I guess you're going to have to go out there now with your families and find out what they do sound like. 92 different frogs, 92 different species, or are there some
16
repeat?
Different species.
Okay, 16, yeah, I figured. Okay.
And polywogs, too. And some of the polywogs are hand-chosen because they're the largest, healthiest polywogs, which will ideally hatch into the largest, healthiest frogs.
So frogs come from polywogs.
Yes.
Should I have known that? I feel like I did know that at some point, and it receded. It's Frogs, A Chorus of Colors, and that's the exhibit on display at the Rochester Museum and Science Center only for about another month, January 10th, and then it'll be gone. And can you tell us what's coming in after it, Dan?
We're actually developing a series of internal exhibitions, and we're really excited about a second phase of exhibition elements to go on our new Science on a Sphere theater, which is it's amazing. We're be moving our polar bear into that exhibition gallery and unpacking our meteorite and mineral collection. We have a whole new movement on green infrastructure outside the museum and within the museum. You'll be seeing all new science involved in managing water that runs off urban spaces to protect our ecosystem from the chemicals in that water. We've got a ton of things going on. In fact, for the Christmas season, my team has been working really since the summer, putting together a full program that includes, oh gosh, caroling with Tesla coils that will fire arcs of plasma and play holiday music, laser shows in the planetarium. We have a full suite, something different every day. We look forward to this all year.
All right, very good. Well, Melissa wanted to know, she said, every time you talk about solar on the program, I think about getting an estimate at our house. Haven't done it yet. She just wants to know, are more people actually doing it? Dr. Polly?
Yeah, absolutely. So Rockspot ran a campaign in the southeast quadrant of Rochester this past summer, and hopefully we're going to be doing more in the other quadrants as well.
Solarize Rochester?
Solarize the Flower City, yep.
Solarize the Flower City, yep.
Yep, and so that was a great success, and we really got a lot of people to go out and get quotes, and a number of them signed up for installations as well. And it's really, you know, as more people learn about it and more people learn, you know, how economically viable it is and how short the payback period is, for, you know, 25, 30, 40 years of basically free electricity. A lot more people are doing it, absolutely.
I don't want to give too much of the store away about tomorrow because, again, his colleague, Dr. Susan Spencer, will be on the program tomorrow talking not only about solar but the way forward in terms of making sure various energy sectors can coexist healthily, peacefully. We'll hear from RG&E, and so that'll be an interesting conversation tomorrow. But Dr. Polly, when you were watching Paris for the last week, I mean, I know you've had – you can't watch hour by hour, minute by minute, but – what are you looking for to come out of Paris?
You know, I'm not really sure. To be completely honest, I was so engrossed with a conference last week that went from 8 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. I wasn't able to really watch any of that. So I do need to catch up on what exactly happened there, and I would have to get back to you on that.
But are you a cynic on government action on these kind of things? Do you think it has to come from a grassroots level, or do you think government action can...
I think all of them are involved. I think that, you know, there really needs to be a groundswell of people that really want this technology and really force the government's hand, but I think the government can certainly play an important role as well.
All right. Remind our listeners, two Thursdays from now, I want our speakers to kind of just give a short encapsulation of what they're going to be presenting on as we get ready to close the hour with our monthly science roundtable. Stephen Polly presenting on the 17th, that is 9 days from now, and that's at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Short encapsulation on what you'll be presenting on.
So I'll be talking about sort of the history of solar cells, where they've come from, where they're going, and where they are now. Talk about the technology, how it works, the physics of it, and ending with sort of the nanotechnology approaches that are having the very high efficiency devices now that I was working on for my PhD.
And that's what we didn't really touch on too much of in this hour, but when it comes to nanotech, can you give us a brief idea for how it plays into solar?
Yeah, so putting nano-sized materials into your solar cells can manipulate the way that light interacts with them. And there's a number of different approaches. Some are in actually converting the photons, which is what I worked on. There's other nanotechnologies that are meant to help capture the photons, so keep them from reflecting back off of the cell. And all of those are approaches to increasing the number of photons converted to electrons and create more power, so more efficiency.
How are you manipulating the nanomaterials?
So for my particular research, I was putting in quantum dots, which are these nanometer-sized sort of lenslet-type materials that they have a much different structure and a much different band gap is what it's called. It's able to convert light that would normally go right through, like light going through a window, it'd normally be lost. But it can convert that light into electricity that would normally not be there. And we're able to manipulate at this very, very tiny scale and use quantum confinement, quantum mechanics basically, to change the way that light interacts with the device and increase the efficiency.
And forgive the super ignorant question, but let our listeners and the hosts know how you're able to see what you're manipulating.
So the way that we can look at the quantum dots is a technique called atomic force microscopy. And so that is basically, it's almost like a record player on a really small scale. And instead of measuring the vibrations electronically of the stylus, you're measuring them with a laser. And you're able to see these very, very small diameter and small height devices. And as far as the actual electrical and optical performance, we have a very comprehensive lab in the Nanopower Research Labs at RIT under Dr. Seth Hubbard, my advisor and now the director of that lab, we're able to look at the effects of putting these very small devices in and see the very real, you know, contributions of those nanostructures to the efficiency and the collection of light across the spectrum of our solar cells.
Do you just get used to looking at it? Is it pretty easy to deal with once you're using them?
Yeah, the first time you do it, it's very awe-inspiring. It does really continue to be awe-inspiring, but you do get a little bit used to it. Like, well, I'm looking at something that's 2 nanometers high and 15 nanometers wide, and it's normal, and I'm counting them. And
yeah. See, that's where I was going. That's the kind of thing that most of us will never get a chance to do, and we're fortunate that people like Dr. Stephen Pauly are doing it. So you can hear his presentation on photovoltaics, history, future, nanotechnology, two Thursdays from now at RMSC. And Thursday night, a free presentation is John O'Donnell, Are We Wired to Think or Just Thinking of Wires? And John, the short description of what you'll be talking about on Thursday night?
On Thursday night, I'll be taking a historical perspective, sort of from how we first came from seeing how the brain works through injury and just very basic ways of looking at it, and building that up into the more modern techniques, or some of the more modern techniques that we've been using to try to bridge that gap between what we know about behavior and what we know about the individual cells, the neurons in the brain, and how they work.
All right, very good. That's Thursday night, and that's out at the Rochester Museum and Science Center as well. Want to thank our guests for coming in. We had some listeners asking about the brain's reaction to injury and concussion. I know there's a film with Will Smith coming out. A lot of people are interested in that. We're going to be talking about that on the program coming up in weeks to come. Is that something that are you interested in, brain injury and recovery of the brain? Is that?
I do some work with that, and definitely a lot of work in the lab focused on that. But
well, thanks for taking the time. That's John O'Donnell. He is a PhD candidate at the University of Rochester, and it's great to have you here, John. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Evan.
Dr. Stephen Pauly, who is a PhD in microsystems engineering from RIT, a member of Rockspot, and presenting as well at RMSC. We'll see you two Thursdays from now, and we'll see your colleague on this program tomorrow. Dr. Pauly, thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot, Evan.
And Dan Manili is the Chief Science Officer for the Rochester Museum and Science Center. And Dan, I know you've got a lot going on out there. Thanks for updating our community on what's happening at RMSC this hour.
Thank you.
And online where? Where's the website, Dan?
RMSC.org.
RMSC.org. Thanks for listening to the monthly Science Roundtable here on Connections. Thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of this program, and Megan Mack, the producer. And thanks to Barsook Records for the music of Rah Rah Riot that you're hearing right now. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio.